morning and welcome to Rising. So I had an interesting start to my day, Brianna.
Oh, yeah.
I parked my car downstairs in the parking structure, but you have to leave your keys with the guy. It's a valet lot. And I got up here and I'm like, oh no, I have the keys. But I left the car running. So yeah. I guess they can move it without the car. You know what? It's one of the remote start things. So you take
As a non-driver, this is news to me. I didn't know that was even possible, but I'm glad you made it here. Okay, yeah.
I'm sure our viewers are fascinated with this saga. Let's just get right into the show, Brianna. What is going on?
Well, longtime Biden aide and White House chief of staff, Ron Klain, will leave his post sometime in February, according to senior administration officials. Klain's exit is expected to precede broader changes in the West Wing as some staffers leave to work the 2024 campaign season. Though a successor has yet to be publicly announced, the Washington Post reports that corporate executive and former Facebook board of directors member Jeff Zients has been tapped for the job. Zients, who before the pandemic had no public health experience, previously served in the White House as COVID response coordinator from 2020 to 2021, where he spearheaded the Biden administration's national vaccination campaign.
Zients' corporate past as an entrepreneur, executive, and investor are leading corruption watchdogs to sound alarm bells. As reported by The Prospect last year, disclosures from 2021 revealed that Zients was worth some $81.4 million, in part due to his management and investment in several for-profit healthcare companies, which over the years had been forced to pay tens of millions of dollars to settle allegations of Medicare and Medicaid fraud. In a recent statement, the Revolving Door Project slammed Zients' expected appointment, writing, quote, "Americans are appalled by profiteering in healthcare, by which Jeff Zients has become astonishingly rich. Americans are aghast at how social media companies have built monopolies and violated privacy laws. Zients served on the board of directors of Facebook as it was defending itself against growing attacks from both political parties. We are deeply worried that Zients will prevent the administration from exercising power righteously on behalf of an already cynical populace." Yeah, you think?
I remember back when, you know, people like FDR were heralded for hiring people who were farmers to be in the Department of Agriculture, people who knew what they were doing. These days, it seems you don't get a plum job unless you were literally working for the people that in government you're supposed to be regulating and providing a check against for the interest of the American public. It's outrageous. And the fact is, Ron Klain was not a good guy either. Ron Klain was similarly involved in any number of revolving door style activities, and people were concerned about what it meant for him to be Biden's senior advisor. But all of the concerns, I'm in the left community, I obviously saw them emerging from a left context, were completely and totally ignored. And my cynical read on this is, despite Zients having links to both the maligned healthcare industry and the maligned social media industry with Facebook, This is going to be a blip. And because it's Biden doing it, it's going to be okay in the eyes of liberals.
This guy sounds like Ron Klain, but harder, faster, stronger.
Yeah.
Honestly, he sounds designed in a lab to infuriate you and I.
Not designed in a lab, Ron.
Excuse us. Yeah, watch our interview later. We're going to actually talk about that more. But I mean that he both has this history of coming from the healthcare industry, making tons of money there in a way that probably does inflame a lot of left concern. And then also has this history of being, he was an advisor to Facebook.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I talked in my radar last week. I've been talking a lot about my concern based on those emails I obtained and uncovered between the CDC and Meta, the parent company of Facebook. I'm so concerned about Facebook being pressured to make bad COVID moderation decisions by the government, the same way that we know that Twitter has been pressured, you know, the Twitter files and all that. And here we have, entering the White House, someone who is very well connected at Facebook, who will know exactly the right levers to push and to pull, exactly the right people to talk to, because that is an important subtext of all this. These are private companies. Finding the right guy to bring your grievances to is very important. We've learned that in our own dealings, or I have at least in my own dealings with, you know, being suppressed, our show on YouTube, et cetera, who you have to talk to. It helps to know someone. It really does. And he knows everybody there. And he has a history of the COVID policy. Like, this is a perfect storm of potential to pressure social media companies to restrict information.
Yeah. And by the way, in his previous role with pandemic management, he had no prior experience with that. To working in healthcare, being involved, representing these healthcare industry actors, apparently making a lot of money from overcharging the government, overcharging for Medicare and Medicaid payments, is not the same thing as having any insight into how to manage a pandemic. So it seems like this guy is just failing up, and you have to start asking the question, if he's not actually substantively qualified for these roles in terms of his life experience, what are his qualifications? And it's hard to ignore that, to your point, it seems like the real value add that he brings is being connected with exactly the kind of industries that are causing disaster in the American government and for the American people.
Yeah, it sounds like a mess. Even his name, Zions. It's I am the Zions.
Trust the Zions.
Trust the Zions. I mean, this is almost bordering on parody. It's interesting that this is the first serious change up in the White House administration. Biden so far has had remarkable continuity at cabinet. No one has left the cabinet yet, I don't think.
Jen Psaki was a turnover.
But Trump had gone through, I think, multiple press secretaries. I think he'd already had a chief of staff change. I think he'd already had some cabinet changes. He had a lot of turnover.
He forced Sanders to get that makeover, remember?
Wait, what did he do?
He was upset with what's her name?
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, governor of Arkansas.
Yes, do you remember there was that news story where he apparently critiqued the aesthetic of some of his staff members and made them kind of all go out and get tans and blowouts and a little wardrobe tweak? Oh, yeah, he's number one aesthetic.
I remember him telling Ronna Romney McDaniel, the head of the RNC, to no longer call herself Ronna Romney McDaniel, just Ronna McDaniel, which she did.
So, yeah, you're right. There has been a certain degree of continuity. It is interesting that the framing of this is people are leaving in anticipation of 2024. So what do you make of that? Because there were these rumors that perhaps the timing of the public disclosure of these documents that were found in Biden's garage was the Democratic Party trying to push him out of running in 2024. There are all of these hopefuls that have been waiting in the wings, the Buttigieg's, the Klobuchar's, the Kamala Harris's that are waiting in the wings. Do you think there's any truth to that? Or does this, is this some indication that Biden's definitely going to run?
I don't. Is Secretary Mayor Pete competent enough to to smuggle a box of documents into Joe Biden's garage so that he can run for president 4 years earlier?
Well, not that they were planted, but that the discovery that, you know, I know that a lot of conservatives have been saying they waited till after midterms to save the Democratic Party, but saving the Democratic Party and saving Biden are two different things. And this is the kind of disclosure that was going to come out ordinarily, or is this people in the Democratic
I guess I can't
Party?
Put it past the Democratic Party to being this self-sabotaging, but hurting Biden. I'm saying this from a neutral standpoint, not from who I would prefer or what policies I think are correct, but Joe Biden is going to run for president again, and trying to take him out of the game is to whose benefit? It's in order to have Kamala Harris earlier, quicker. That doesn't seem to benefit the Democratic Party to me. I mean, Joe Biden, say whatever you want to say about him, is defiantly popular compared to other people in the Democratic Party.
I think that's right, but there is this history of trying to get Biden not to run. Obviously, he stepped aside in 2016, not to the Democratic Party's benefit.
Right, that was a huge mistake from a Democratic point of view.
Yeah, huge mistake. And it didn't look like they were necessarily prepared to coalesce around Biden. He was trailing throughout the primary and including the first few
because he was losing the primaries, but he was always he was mostly ahead in the polls.
Always one or two.
The polls showed that he was eventually was going to come down to him and Bernie.
Yeah,
which is
but the first three states, I think he was in third to fifth place in each of those states, and you know it didn't seem like the party necessarily was ready to back him until it became clear that was the only way that they were going to beat Bernie Sanders.
So, or it means we have to stop taking Iowa so seriously.
Well, the Democratic Party's fixed that, too, changing the order of the primaries so that Joe Biden will have a clear advantage. So that's another piece of evidence in favor of a definite Biden run. Now, people like Bernie have said they absolutely won't run if Biden does run, but there was news over the weekend. Marianne Williamson said she has launched an exploratory committee, so we'll see if there's a progressive challenger. Lots of interesting stuff to look forward to in 2024.
Imagine a pro-Biden cabal and an anti-Biden cabal plotting to move the primary dates to help him, one plotting to find classified documents to destroy him. Very funny. We'll continue to cover that story as it develops. Still to come today on Rising, Alaimi Aluren will join us to discuss the police shooting deaths of a major Black Lives Matter official's relative. Plus, Ghislaine Maxwell has given her first televised interview since entering prison. We'll tell you all about that, what she has to say for herself. That's up ahead, as well as our radars, which are coming up next. Stay tuned.
What's on your radar today, Robbie?
Well, the World Economic Forum's yearly meeting has come to an end, and the world's wealthy corporate elites and government leaders are heading back home to continue strategizing about how best to fight climate change. Never mind the 150-plus private jets they took to the conference in Davos. As we discussed last week, one of the central themes of this year's conference, in addition to climate change, was the supposed crisis of online disinformation, the failure of social media platforms to restrict false information and prevent the gullible masses from consuming it, was held up as the central problem for our times. Because how else can the authorities at Davos figure out how to move us around like chess pieces if we keep doing unexpected things because we're reading sources of information they don't approve of, that clash with their preferred priorities and preferences? World Economic Forum leaders are fully committed to fighting the war in Ukraine for as long as it takes, and they can't have the people getting too upset about the food shortages and energy prices that are resulting from it. Former CNN anchor Brian Stelter hemmed a panel on disinformation in which a U.S. Democratic politician and the publisher of the New York Times discussed how best to weigh the trade-offs between your right to free speech and their need to shut you up. But it was the remarks by another panelist that most captured the internet's attention. This remark by European Commission member Vera Jourova went viral. Let's watch.
Well, we need the people who understand the language and the case law in the country. Mm. Because what qualifies as hate speech, as illegal hate speech, which you will have soon also in the US, I think that we have a strong reason why we have this in the criminal law.
In that clip, Jourova announces that she believes European-style hate speech laws, which criminalize transgressive and offensive political statements, will be coming to the U.S. Jourova is the European Union's Commissioner for Values and Transparency. You have to admit she's being fairly transparent about her values there. More recently, she also had this to say on the subject of Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter.
After Mr. Musk took over the Twitter with his freedom of speech absolutism, we are the protectors of freedom of speech as well. But at the same time, we cannot accept, for instance, the illegal content online and so on. So our message was clear. We have the rules which have to be complied with, and otherwise there will be sanctions.
Follow the rules or face the sanctions. That's the EU's message for Elon Musk. She also said the time of the Wild West is over and that social media companies must behave themselves so as not to cause harm. We know what the Davos authorities mean by harm. They mean scrutiny of Western governments' COVID policies. They mean open criticism of China's communist authoritarians and questions about whether China's lax lab safety protocols were responsible for the entire pandemic. They mean vocal opposition to the war in Ukraine. Any challenge to the resolve that they believe all democratic nations must show. In other words, they mean dissent. Thankfully, the U.S. is not part of the European Union, and we have a little thing called the First Amendment that ostensibly prohibits the federal government from censoring our words just because they might be provocative or controversial or not entirely agreed upon. Our federal government wishes, of course, that it had broad power to control our speech. Federal bureaucrats' constant pressuring of social media companies to moderate content is a worrisome example and shows how our government will always try to get around the First Amendment. Even so, Americans have a lot more protections than their European counterparts, at least for now. Make no mistake, the Davos enforcers have noticed that Elon Musk is offering, or at least promising, a more open and less regulated Twitter platform. They don't like it one bit.
Yeah, Robbie, I mean, it's interesting. We had this kind of comparative law conversation on my podcast last week. We were talking about the controversy around Brazilian speech laws and some criticisms that Glenn Greenwald has been making and then some criticisms he's been receiving as a consequence of perhaps critiquing Brazilian speech standards. as though they are American speech standards. And even though I think that we're here all invested in our speech standards and the First Amendment and having a more, or let's say, less restricted version of freedom of speech, it is in fact the case that other countries have made different kinds of decisions, and their laws are different, and their constitutions, to the extent that they have them, say different things. So I don't know. I think it is true, obviously, that other places like the EU or Brazil, they have something more broad hate speech laws. They are restricted from saying certain things. My guest talking about Brazil was talking about how, you know, racism was illegal, and it's a little difficult to wrap one's brain around. But then you think, well, we have restrictions in our own speech here with respect to, you could call not being allowed to kick someone out of a restaurant because they're black making racism illegal in the United States. I mean, we all live on some kind mm-hmm. of a spectrum. And I guess my question is this. You know, we live in a global society. We have these global corporations like Twitter. What, you know, is it really so nefarious? I mean, we don't have to like it. We don't like what other countries' rules are. But is it really nefarious for the EU to say a company operating in its country has to obey its speech laws, and the same for Brazil and the same for the United States of America, that we'll have fewer restrictions because that's what our laws
say? No, of course not. It's absolutely fine for different countries, different civilizations, different groups of people to organize and have different rules for how they want to live. I think that's totally fine. What we worry about here is at Davos is people saying, oh, this is what we do in our country, and thus, and we're an elite Western successful democracy, this should be exported everywhere. This should be the standard for everyone. I mean, that's what she said, sort of said at least, mm-hmm. in that conversation we played from Davos, where she's saying, I bet hate speech laws will be coming
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, I mean, it sounded to me, and again, I don't have a dog in this fight, but it sounded to me like she was just saying, it seems like there are growing concerns around mm-hmm. You know, misinformation in the United States, which is obviously true, particularly among the people from America who are talking at Davos. And maybe they've given her the indication that there's a growing appetite for hate speech laws, expanding hate speech laws, which at various times in history, there is always mm-hmm. an appetite for expanding those kind of laws. Now, I don't know how much that is actually likely. In fact, the laws that we have seen being promulgated right now in the last few weeks of 2023 include a number of extremely authoritarian laws that I spoke about on my radar last week, including a ban on wearing what you want in drag, wearing drag, point blank period, the banning right. of a number of books.
Such a ban that, by the way, would not survive a legal challenge
sure,
on First Amendment grounds.
Yeah, but it still is the case that, you know, conservatives across the country are promulgating these extremely authoritarian laws. There's a ban on all of these books in Florida. I talked to a math teacher on my show last night. He said it affected him. And I said, why? It's math books. He said, I don't know, but there's 45 books that we've been told, maybe it was 55 books that we've been told we can't use anymore. So, I mean, I don't know. I sometimes think that we're overly rosy about what the First Amendment is actually doing for us. It is a stop. It is a backstop, mm-hmm. that it's an important one. But it doesn't mean that these people aren't right. There are definitely anti-speech authoritarian impulses happening in this country, both from people who would want to make hate speech illegal and people who would want to make, I don't know, me wearing pants illegal.
Okay, but they can sue. Like, the First Amendment does protect that. At the end of the day, we're better off with that. Also, to your point about, you know, having different policies. So obviously, I'm not an expert in the European Union and how it is formed and how people get the position in there and to what extent it's democratically representative of what the people think. I know many that there are European conservatives, including the whole Brexit movement, right, that had criticisms of how decisions are reached under the European sure. Union framework, whether that's actually representative of, I mean, this is a world government for Europe, right? Is it respective of the different, the many different countries within its purview who have their own distinct histories and customs and rules. I don't know if the kinds of the ways the hate speech law is applied. I mean, in Britain, the hate speech law has been applied to arrest and ticket people for, like, posting rap lyrics on Facebook.
Yeah, there was that incident during the Queen's funeral where people were followed for holding up signs that were critical yeah. of Prince Andrew. I mean, it's wild stuff. It certainly doesn't pass
muster. Very wild. Yeah, not even close.
You know,
And what I'm saying is I don't even yeah. know if the people agree with that. If this is a European Union dictate, is it just the elites getting together at Davos and they have these jobs that aren't particularly democratically accountable? They're more like you know, the workings of our inner deep, our federal official, our bureaucrats, yeah. and they're coming up with these policies, and they're not constrained because they don't have a First Amendment, and they're not really accountable either.
You know, my impression of things is that it's a mixed bag, the same way that we feel like the fact of us having free speech here, having the First Amendment here, means that there's some bad outcomes that we don't like, but we live with because we think it's all better for the better and the balance. Mm-hmm. We don't like Nazis walking through the streets, but we accept it because that's the price of freedom. Mm-hmm. I think on the other side, there are moments that are too restricted that people don't like, but they think on balance, it's good because it's worth the price of not having Nazis march in the street. You know, again, in this Brazilian context, the guest I was talking to, Andrew Fishman, who is the head of the Intercept Brazil, he's an American, but he's been living there for like 10 or 15 years, speaks Portuguese, you know, and he was saying, yeah, I have an American sensibility. But I also realize that we live in a country that very recently just got out of a military coup. There are rules in place to prevent the military, which is not as independent as the American military is, from undermining democracy. You can't post things that encourage there to be a military coup and saying things like this. Racism is illegal here, and it is, you know, I understand why these laws are in place, given this political context, as compared to the American one, where we haven't really ever gone through that kind of a political moment. And The Intercept Brazil, it has gone through a lot of like censorship and attacks on speech. It has been a real bête noire of the media infrastructure in Brazil, and it has had to live with the consequences of that. But even that being the case, he was like, look, I get it. He wasn't making an argument for one side or another. But I think that we are all a little naive about the negative implications about whatever regime that we choose for ourselves. And it was interesting to have this conversation where someone was willing to say, look, there are downsides, and you just basically have to decide what point from which you want to start arguing. What point do you want people to have to sue from, this side or that mm-hmm. side?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not just our principles, though, right, that causes us to, or causes liberal-minded people to support free speech in the First Amendment. Also an idea, maybe an unproven, maybe people disagree with this, but an idea that not suppressing even toxic ideology, that suppressing them makes them more attractive to certain people and can backfire and doesn't, that you can't stop this even very dangerous Nazism. Like, you can't stamp it out by making it illegal, by making it forbidden. You actually draw people to it, or you make it seem like it's being persecuted and it's being there. Well, if people are so afraid of us, why, or if we're so crazy, why won't they let us speak? Why are they afraid that you might hear what we have to say? And it totally backfires. And so that actually allowing that is a healthy way to operate in a liberal society.
I'm generally moved by that argument, but the counter argument that people bring up, it's worth noting, is that there have been these instances of people who have been disappeared from social media. Again, I'm not advocating for this, but there are people who have basically been truly canceled from social media, not just performatively, oh, I've quit my job at a university and now I'm going to start a Substack. No, like actually fired and limited on social media, who have largely just left the public consciousness because they haven't been able to find an alternative audience. Even Donald Trump, for all that he's still obviously a major political figure, had, I think, a significant dent to his social relevancy after he was kicked off of Twitter. People like Milo Yiannopoulos, when they were canceled by their own community years ago, largely just completely disappeared because they weren't on social media, and also even Breitbart and the Republicans weren't talking to him anymore.
I think that's a mixed bag, because attempts to stop him from speaking at universities was his whole stick.
Right, right. I completely agree. So that's what I say. I generally speaking, am moved by the argument that censorship as a whole doesn't get to the root of the problem that you have, like Milo Yiannopoulos' actually belief system. But there are these counterexamples that I think are worth paying attention to.
Well, we got to leave it there. We'll have more Rising right after this. We've been covering the dispute in conservative media between The Daily Wire, a major conservative content publisher, where of Ben Shapiro's site, Jeremy Boring, Matt Walsh, Candace Owens, and others, their dispute with Steven Crowder, who's a conservative YouTube star who doesn't like the terms of the contract they offered him, and is, in fact, so offended by it, he is accusing them of being in bed with big tech. Crowder was on Tim Pool's show last night to give his version of events. Let's play some of that.
You go to The Daily Wire. They say, here's a term sheet. You go, whoa, this is crazy. Right. Hey, you can't do this. The Daily Wire then says, all of a sudden, not also, but a few months later, Crowder registers StopBigCon. Then he calls and secretly records Jeremy. He was setting us up. This email right here, paints a different picture in that you talked with the Daily Wire and said, here's our issue.
Yeah.
Here's what we can't do. And they said, okay. And then sometime later, they try punching.
No, they said, if that's the issue, this is our business model. And you don't know business.
But then they try and poach one of your employees.
So this is really getting, I guess, not out of control, but it's heating up. It's a big deal, this dispute. Crowder says that the terms of the contract they offered him, so basically the issue is, in the contract it said if he gets demonetized on various platforms, then they're going to start deducting how much they pay him. They're going to start subtracting the total amount they pay him. And initially when people heard that, they were pretty outraged by it. Then it later came out, but the total amount they're paying him is $50 million over 3 years, and also he has to pay staff, et cetera. It's still a lot of money. Then I think people were much less sympathetic, and also Jeremy Boring, the co-founder of the Daily Wire, did a long video where he explained, where he tried to say, "Look, this was our opening bid. This is a document we sent him. We could have negotiated with him further if he didn't like specific aspects of it. But bottom line is, we were offering him a huge amount of money. It's not that we like having to punish people if they get taken down on YouTube or where else. We hate that. But the reality is, if you're not being monetized on those platforms, you're then not worth that amount of money. Mm-hmm. So we can't just give you millions and millions of dollars if you're no longer able to realize value for us, mm-hmm. like we're running a business here," mm-hmm. which I think is a pretty persuasive argument, frankly. But
what kind of things was he being demonetized? What kind of statements?
So Steven Crowder, he's a very provocative conservative. He's gotten in trouble, I think, for COVID stuff. He interviewed Alex Jones on a show once, just kind of let Alex Jones say whatever he wants to say. And again, the Daily Wire and Crowder, and probably even you and I on some of this stuff, agree that these policies that the various platforms have to punish you, we've gotten unfairly punished.
Sure.
I think it's BS a lot of times. They're not saying they like that, but that's just the reality.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't like expect that amount of money. And then but with no strings attached, no matter what happens, we're going to keep giving you that amount of money, is what the Daily Wire said. Crowder has said, but you're values-driven. You have said your values are being against the whole big tech model, and yet it's written into your contracts that this is how you operate. And then he's tried to suggest that he's more upset about, it's not for his own sake, but for how they might treat like a younger, he keeps using the word kid, although it could be a person of any age, but a person starting out in conservative content creating, and he would describe them as being shackled to this contract. And then he had a conversation with Jeremy Boring where he surreptitiously recorded Boring saying whatever he said about how that would be, you know, that would they'd be wage slaves for a little bit. And he's kind of been playing that as a gotcha. And the people at the Daily Wire and a lot of people are really upset that he would, you know, like secretly record what used to be a friend and then try to humiliate them. So that's where the state of things is. Let's also play Candace Owens. So a lot of Daily Wire people are firing back, defending Daily Wire. Candace Owens has in multiple interviews. She was on Timcast as well. She recently said this, I believe, on her own podcast. Let's play that.
Over the weekend, I was given a lot more information regarding Steven Crowder, a lot more background information regarding what could have possibly led to this moment. And not to my surprise at all, obviously, this really doesn't have anything to do with the Daily Wire. And his actions are a symptom of something much larger. And I want to choose my words very carefully here because I'm not angry anymore. Steven has a lot going on. I guess is the best way to say it. He has a lot going on, and that should be clear because people don't do stuff like this if there's not a lot going on in their lives. You don't sell out your friend. You don't record conversations. These things are actions of individuals that are perhaps acting out of desperation. You have to dig deeper. You have to look deeper to fully understand the picture of why somebody might do that. And it's certainly not because somebody is upset with a $50 million contract. And because I now am more aware of certain information, rather than being angry, I would like to implore my audience and everybody that isn't paying attention to this situation not to condemn him, but to pray for him. Sometimes people need a prayer. Sometimes people need a scripture. You know, Stephen purports to be a Christian, and I believe that he needs to lean into his faith. And I am certain that in the near future, more information will come out. I do not think it is my place to say more than that. Well, probably what I should say is I am unsure at this moment if it is my place to say more than that.
So I saw many people talking about this as a kind of threat.
Yeah, that was a threat.
Blackmail.
That was a threat. I don't know what she's referring to. Previously, her and other Daily Wire people have suggested that, you know, Crowder may sound like he's just doing this. This is a moral stance. But, of course, in positioning himself against the Daily Wire and framing them as compromised and colluding with big tech, he's calling more attention to himself. He can launch an independent channel and say, like, well, but I will never lie to you. I'll never censor myself or hold back. I'm not beholden to this big corporation, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That's a shtick people do.
Mm, all the time.
I think that's a, we know some people who've done that. I think that's a fair criticism from them. I don't know what she's getting after there. That was insane.
Yeah, there's obviously some implication that there's something going on in his personal life that she's, you know, not going to talk about right now, but might talk about in the future.
If he keeps talking.
Right. As someone who's not involved in this media sphere, a couple of things strike me. One, the need for all of the other content creators to weigh in seems odd. It seems like they should just stay out of it. And I don't know that this necessarily makes Daily Wire look better. If it were normal employment context, I think everyone would be told to not weirdly gossip and make public statements about internal company goings on. It's also a little odd to me that there is like a circling of the wagons around management. I guess everybody else's contracts are very good.
Well, they're $50 million. What are you? You'd feel pretty positively disposed toward your management if they were giving you $50 million, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. It'd be interesting to know.
Even you, Brianna, even the unionizing progressive crusader.
Well, I would presume that there was something in my contract terms that I could guarantee by money, regardless of whether or not I had some criticism of management. You know, I've been allowed to be critical of things here at the Hill that I've disagreed with in the past, and I wouldn't be here if I felt like I was precluded from doing so.
No, I joke. They disagree all the time. Ben Shapiro did eventually start criticizing Candace Owens for her perceived defenses of Kanye West.
Perceived defenses.
Yeah, actual defenses.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I think it's definitely interesting. It's good content. Maybe that's why everyone's allowed, if not encouraged, to go ahead and weigh in.
Yeah.
It would also, I think it does seem to be likely that Crowder is setting himself up for a departure. It's just unclear to me why it is that he is quite so upset about what is ultimately a very lucrative contract and also one that only is imperiled if he gets canceled on the social media outlets. Mm-hmm. So unless he thinks he's being censored or demonetized, rather, for unfair things that are outside of his control, it seems like a kind of an easy workaround.
Well, and he said he's already demonetized on YouTube, so he was very worried about that being in the contract. Like, he's already in that state. The Daily Wire people said, like, okay, again, this was just kind of a boilerplate thing we put in front of your face. We could have negotiated it. If that was going to be a sticking point, we could have changed that. But you abruptly cut ties with us, and then weeks later started attacking us, maybe in that clip with Tim Pool, it sounds like he's kind of disputing that timeline. So I don't know. The thing I think that is not totally wrong with what Crowder is saying is that there is this kind of condemnation of big tech and the platforms without a lot of, by organizations that do have to work with them. And maybe that's fine, but it is something that's going on. I think the Daily Wire does get right is that it's just not, perhaps they didn't frame it in a way so that he could understand it necessarily.
Probably this is the same thing that's been going on with the Twitter files. It's like there's a narrative that says the big tech is like evil and out to get you. But what we're seeing a lot of is, you know, even the government, even the CDC is feeling misled by government or by big pharma. It's all of these corporations that have competing interests that are fighting for what their own interests are. And it's not this like evil, nefarious, big-headed monster that it's being framed as being. So yeah, like it doesn't surprise me or strike me as especially hypocritical that the head of this conservative media outlet would both not like the censorship and also want to create contract terms that accommodate for
right.
this.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
this is capitalism.
No, right, I agree.
People want to make money, and these are the consequences. They will censor you for money. That is the whole point
I also
of capitalism.
Agree, and I also agree with them that it's a really low move to record someone you think you're friendly with without their permission and then leak that. Although, on Tim Pool's show, Crowder brought up, but we all applaud this, we being everyone in the conservative movement, applauds this when James O'Keefe does it, when he's calling to light abuses in big government and big corporations, big media corporations. We all applaud it. And that's what I did. And you're saying there's something wrong with that? And I think that's kind of a good
flashback. I don't entirely understand the moralizing around the recording of the call. Sometimes it's illegal to record a call one-sided, depending on what state it is. But assuming that there's no actual legal implications here, they can say that they're friends. I don't know what their relationship is, but this was a kind of a business negotiation context. And, you know, people keep record calls for their records. They know what was said, so they know what they should be arguing. Mm-hmm. Leaking it and recording it, I think, are two kind of separate things. But I don't know. I'm very interested to see how this all plays out.
Well, both Crowder and anyone in leadership at the Daily Wire, standing invitation to come on and make their case if they would like. We'll be back with more Rising right after this.
Unredacted emails from the National Institutes of Health reveal a concerted effort to rule out a lab leak origin to the coronavirus pandemic. Jimmy Tobias, an environmental reporter for The Intercept, is here with us to discuss his reporting. Welcome, Jimmy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the implication here is that there was a result that people were wanting, which was that lab leak was not the origin of COVID. Can you tell us what in the documents implies that's the case?
Well, really, the documents are an inside look at concerns in the early, very early days of the pandemic among top virologists that the virus looked potentially engineered. And what followed from that, after Dr. Fauci was alerted to these concerns in late January 2020, was a series of telephone calls and email conversations in which the origin of the virus was discussed confidentially between Fauci, Dr. Collins, and a group of the world's top virologists. And early on in some of these calls, there were several scientists who really couldn't figure out how this virus was produced in nature, given some of its unusual features. Others on the calls and emails disagreed with that perspective. And so they had a debate that lasted more than a week, really.
Yeah, I remember hearing Fauci's deposition from a couple weeks ago as part of the Missouri lawsuit, and he talked about being prepped for that call. I believe he was his assistant gave him a document to go over that was including, I think, concerns about gain of function research and it producing exactly something like this. And his memory was not. Was not super specific when he was revisiting it. So do you have an understanding from reviewing these documents, so where it went from, like, how did it go from being, I guess, an open question to then, for a period of time, something, it was not an open question anymore. It was shut. You were not supposed to say that. Now it's an open question again, but there was that long period following that initial debate period where it was, like, decided that that was not something you were supposed to think.
Yeah, well, during these conversations, they started circulating drafts of what would become the proximal origin paper, which was a paper that was very influential in shaping the early debate about COVID's origins. But these early drafts, you can see as they kind of evolve in these conversations, they couldn't, you know, they really didn't come down one way or the other on whether it was a lab origin or whether it was a natural origin. And even by February 8th, more than a week after these conversations started, this one of the key players here, Christian Anderson of Scripps, you know, was saying we don't really have enough data quite to come down one way or the other. We shouldn't publish yet. That was February 8th. You know, by early March, they had submitted their paper to Nature Medicine. It had been accepted. And that final version of the paper was much more conclusive in what it found. You know, it came down pretty strongly in favor of a natural origin. And it is, you know, one of the questions that the emails kind of leave one asking is kind of how did they overcome that initial uncertainty? And it's really not clear in the documents. And I'll add, you know, these are FOIA documents. They don't capture what went on in these phone calls. So it's not entirely clear what their thinking process was. And, you know, the people I spoke to for this article had different interpretations of what happened here. Some people felt, you know, this was the scientific process at work. They had these concerns, they collected some data, they came to a conclusion and they published. Others felt that these documents that they showed, you know, this sort of effort to downplay the lab theory. And the conversations that were happening here, you can sense the urgency and the anxiousness. And to your question about Dr. Fauci, he did go, you know, he was alerted to concerns that the virus was potentially engineered on January 31st. The next day, they organized a sort of hastily convened conference call with Dr. Fauci and some of the world's top virologists. And before that call, you know, Dr. Fauci went to his deputy and was like, fill me in on what we've been, our relationships with institutions in China, like what we've been funding, what we've been working on. So he prepared, in a sense, for this call, as that deposition shows.
I mean, the unspoken aspect of these conversations around lab leak theories, I mean, I think we all understand it, but it's worth saying out loud, is that if there is a human origin to this thing, then the liability implications of this, that, you know, a disease that has killed millions of people globally, that has wrecked the global economy, which shut down many countries for months or years, is incredible. And there's an incredible amount of incentive to not come down with this being a man-made virus. That being the case, I mean, it seems to me like the story here could potentially be that initially nobody knew. After a couple of months of investigation and research into the, you know, genetic reality of this thing, the scientists put their head together and decided that there wasn't a lot of evidence for it to be a lab leak. But given what we know now and how the conversation has opened back up with a lot of credible people saying that this is like a plausible path for investigation, it really does seem, it does seem in a lot of people's eyes to be something more nefarious. That, in fact, there was an effort to get some document published quickly and on the books that would validate public sources and saying anybody who was talking about lab leak theory is a crazy kook. And so I wonder what you make of it, having been closer to the documents, obviously, than either of us. What inferences do you draw from how this played out?
Well, look, our goal in publishing this article was to take what are clearly very publicly important documents, you know, documents that show what one of the most influential people involved in the pandemic response was doing and thinking in the early days. We wanted to take those documents, put them in context, you know, incorporate different perspectives from experts and present them to readers to help them make their own conclusions. So, you know, really my goal here was, you know, an issue of the Freedom of Information Act. I was interested in these documents. We filed FOIAs. The documents we got back were heavily redacted, and it took more than a year of litigation to get these documents out in the public. So the goal for us was just providing the public information, you know, in these important documents. I think, you know, one of the people I spoke to for this article, Dr. Sergey Pond, who's a computational virologist at Temple, you know, he sort of said, like, you know, early in these documents, you know, the discussion is pretty careful. They're airing out all these ideas, and they come, you know, and they say we don't have the data to make a determination. Later on, they do make a strong determination, and he said, you know, without really new data. So why? And these FOIA documents don't really answer that question, but you know, I think they just provide this very interesting insight into what was being said and done in these early days.
Yeah, it steers you to a kind of suspicion of a political agenda or motivated reasoning or something where you have, it's in everyone's best interest or the best interest of the people in those conversations, the U.S. health apparatus, to reach the conclusion that this was not the result of a scientific incident based on research we were funding, right? It's very much in their interest to reach some other conclusion, even if there's not enough data to say one way or the other. I guess, does that give us concern or pause that, you know, these people, the people in these roles, will have enough independence to, you know, ever properly investigate how this happened, or maybe it's really not on them to do it. It's the information is in China, and we won't know anyway. But if there was an opportunity to know, you would be worried that somehow our people would steer the conversation elsewhere based on all of this, I think.
Well, I mean, you know, there is debate in the scientific community. Not everyone in the scientific community, you know, believes only in natural origin is possible. I mean, I talked to David Roman of Stanford, and he kind of used both as plausible. And so there is, I think, a healthy, if sometimes toxic, debate in the scientific community about this question. And you know, Congress is going to be looking into this. I mean, The House Oversight Committee sent letters to many of the people involved in these discussions just in December, you know, seeking their testimony and documents. So there will be, you know, the representatives of the public will be looking into this further. You know, one would hope that it won't just devolve into partisan bickering and that something positive can actually come out of those discussions. I mean, that remains to be seen. But this is, you know, this is obviously of intense interest to many, many people. And I think that continued investigations into what happened and where this virus came from are really important. And you know, that one of the people I spoke to for the article, Lawrence Gostin, who's at Georgetown, he said these documents are really important. Like, the public deserves to know as much as possible about where this virus came from. And I think that hopefully these investigations, both scientific and you know, governmental, will find something. We'll reach a determination at some point.
And Jimmy, not to put you on the spot and make you remember your high school or college biology, but do you have insight? Can you help to unpack what it is that scientists are looking at to try to judge whether or not this is something that will have the hallmarks of being man-made versus naturally occurring? What is it about the virus that gives people an indication one way or the other?
Yeah, well, the thing in the documents that really stood out to me, and one of the things that I think really puzzled the scientists in these early conversations, was something called it was the presence in the virus's genome of what's called a furin cleavage site, which is a feature that has not been found in other SARS-related coronaviruses. And the furin cleavage site plays an important role in helping the virus infect human airway cells. And so one of the scientists, when he saw the furin cleavage site, he was like, and I quote, like, I have a hard, you know, he has a hard time explaining that event as something outside of a lab. And someone else, when they saw the furin cleavage site in these conversations, was just like, I just don't figure out how this gets accomplished in nature. It's stunning. You know, other scientists on the calls disagreed, but that was really a major hangup for them. And it's unclear from the documents how they overcame their concerns about the furin cleavage site. You know, it's never clear in these documents. And again, we don't have a full picture into the discussions, but that's one outstanding question to me, at least. If these scientists have been willing to speak with me and they weren't, I would have asked them, you know, how did you overcome those concerns about the furin cleavage site? How did you get from A to B?
Well, Jimmy, terrific reporting. Thank you so much for joining us. Keep at it. And we'll have more Rising right after this.
Damar Hamlin of the Buffalo Bills made an appearance at the Bills game yesterday, waving to fans and players from box seats while recovering from the cardiac arrest he suffered earlier this month. However, Hamlin's homecoming was tainted after conspiracy theories spread online, alleging the man seen in the Bills' press box is not Hamlin, but a body double. Theorists particularly want to know why Hamlin's face cannot be clearly seen in his big return. However, Hamlin himself seemed to poke fun at allegations he's been replaced, tweeting a picture of his new mural with the caption, clone.
He got Avril Lavigne. They Avril Lavigne'd him. Do you know that one?
That she's allegedly
she expired. Was killed and replaced.
Yeah. What is going on with the internet right now? I mean, we talk a lot about how crazy misinformation campaigns are and all of this. Uh-huh. But is this nuts that there is a non-zero number of people who think that this is a publicity stunt? Or is it nuts not to think that it could possibly credibly be a publicity stunt?
Wait a minute. I'm feeling...
Did you take the jab, Robbie?
I did, as I said. I took the booster, too.
I mean, this is the thing. Like, as you just alluded to, there's video after video after video of people on the internet doing what looks like, frankly, performative, put upon shaking and accusing the vaccine of that, and other people making fun of it, taking videos of folks twerking and dancing and wrestling and saying,
people don't
Pfizer.
Fall for that kind of thing. We don't know, like, stuff online, you don't know a lot of whether it's genuine, whether you're being duped. I also saw a lot of, you know, we criticized the heck out of the World Economic Forum at Davos, I think for a very good reason. But then I saw some tweets that were just like fake about things, sessions they'd had that were made up, that were not, that had been like
lizard
doctored.
People and, eating faces.
Yeah, yeah. And then they're like, well, okay, maybe that's fake, but that sounds like something they would do. Well, just Just why don't you just share the actual information that they're doing and we'll criticize
that.
Oh,
yeah. Did you see, speaking of misinformation, this is now just the misinformation panel. There was a tweet that launched 1,000 stories about how trans activists think Aretha Franklin's Natural Woman is offensive, move to pull song from Spotify, you know? And it was a parody account making a joke tweet.
Was it?
And it launched like a half a dozen articles at mainstream news publications. And the person who did the initial tweet is like, this is an obvious parody account. Not a single person reached out to me to ask whether this was a real story.
Is that true?
They just all reported on it. Yes. Yes. But see, Robbie, look at you sitting here. Well, it could have been
looking
true.
It up.
It could have happened.
I guess I'm the sucker then.
But, I mean, this is a weird time we live in where the plausibility of something does seem to matter more than the reality of it being true.
Well, no, the reality of the truth should matter, but...
Should, but the conditional tense isn't doing much for us right now, Robbie.
You're telling me the New York Post and the Daily Mail got this wrong?
Many, many people were big upset about something.
The Transcultural Mindfulness Alliance. Oh, they did get tricked. Yeah, that's not going to be... It says parody satire in the Twitter account.
People want bad things to be true so badly. It also says something about our kind of lack of community and desire to own each other before understanding each other. That is, it's not great.
So you, Damar Hamlin, real or fake?
Look,
So I saw him walking into the stand. He's covered.
Yeah, I think the thing to say about it is that the NFL potentially looks very bad. Right. There have been all of these stories about the impact endured by players, whether or not they're sufficiently protected. There was another story of a player having an incident on the field earlier this year that was also very hard to watch. That wasn't that much before the Damar Hamlin situation. And there are questions about whether or not proper precautions have been put into place. The movie Concussion, this has all been, we've been leading up to this.
No, it's years. Very well documented. The blunt force trauma, the impact it can have.
So there's obviously incentive.
And he was hit up here.
Yeah, there's obviously incentive, including financial incentive, for him to be doing well, right?
Yeah.
Like, everyone, the NFL comes out better if he's fine and everything is back to normal. So I will say I understand why people might suspect that there's a push to make everything seem okay, even if it isn't. But I do think that before people jump to conclusions about whether or not this, in fact, was a body double stunt, there needs to be a little bit more than him being covered up.
Well, you want to belt a few notes of Natural Woman, Aretha Franklin, to close us out here?
You're asking me if I want to sing one of the most famous songs by one of the best singers of all time live on the air right now. I do not. I do want to stand in solidarity with that excellent troll account, however. Well done, and I hope everyone takes a beat before jumping to the worst conclusions.
There are a couple really funny parody, the wokeness, they're making fun of wokeness accounts. What is that one, the Buy My Book Bigot one? Do you know what I'm talking about? What is that person's name? That's in their Twitter handle. Buy my book or you're a bigot. It's just very funny.
You know what's funny about the Aretha Franklin thing as well is that I have a friend who's in the LGBT community, who sent me that and was like, this is lame. Like,
really?
He thought it was real, too.
Oh,
but
he
didn't
got
like
closed the other way?
Yeah. Well, no, everyone thought it was real for like a 24-hour period. He thought it was real and that it was stupid. He's like, now if we had all thought about it, like, I don't think the gay community was going to turn on Aretha Franklin. I mean, these songs are too important. But, like, the idea that, like, only conservatives are upset about, like, these quote-unquote woke overreaches is ridiculous. It's not about a left-right thing. Everyone's mad when beloved things are ruined by modernity, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think that is also really instructive.
Titania McGrath. Titania McGrath. That's the account I meant.
And what does Titania McGrath do?
Titania McGrath is an activist, healer, radical intersectional poet, non-white, ecosexual, pronouns variable, selfless and brave, buy my book.
See,
it's a joke.
I get it, but like I can see that being from a left-leaning or a right-leaning account.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. This just truly isn't about politics. And it is odd that one political party has chosen to make this like the sine qua non of its whole political project right now. But that's a whole other story. Crisis averted here. We'll follow up and see what's going on with Damar Hamlin from both a legitimate health perspective and a conspiracy theorist perspective. And we'll have more Rising for you after this. The family of Kenan Anderson has filed a $50 million claim against the Los Angeles Police Department on behalf of the deceased man's five-year-old son. Anderson died on January 3rd after police tased him six times in 42 seconds. Anderson is a cousin to Black Lives Matter National co-founder Patrice Cullors, excuse me. The LAPD said in a press release that Anderson had been seen running in the middle of the street and exhibiting erratic behavior after flagging an officer down following a car accident. Body camera footage has since been released, warning it is disturbing.
Stop it, Irma Tasia. Okay, stop it, Irma Tasia. Stop it, Irma Tasia.
Stop resisting.
Please.
Stop resisting.
Please. 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 I'm a taser.
They're trying to kill me.
Joining us now to weigh in is movement lawyer and political commentator Olayemi Olorun. Welcome back to the show, Ole.
Thank you for having me, y'all.
So it's worth noting there's a longer version of the video where he's on his knees with his hand behind his head complying. He says something about how he wants to be seen and then walks to the middle of the road so that there's more visibility. It seems like he was anticipating on some level an interaction just like this and being, you know, George Floyded, as it were, as he put it. Can you help us unpack how something like this could have happened?
I mean, I guess there isn't really anything for us to unpack, right? Because it's not an anomaly. This is something that happens all the time. We see this quite literally all the time. LAPD killed three different Black men back to back at the top of the year. I know how it happens. Honestly, this is how the police often deal with Black men. His fare made sense to me. Their response, unfortunately, although that makes no sense, I see that very often, so it's routine. So there isn't anything really to unpack because this is the routine thing that we see. We see police murder. Police kill a Black person that doesn't need to be killed, and then you immediately see the media start a campaign to justify it. And that's what we're seeing here from Kenan Anderson. Immediately, all of the narrative is, oh, cocaine and cannabis are found in the system as justifications to kill him, or, oh, he's not complying as justifications to kill him. But at no point are we saying that he's dangerous, that he posed a threat to these men, that there's any reason why he needs to be dead. Having cocaine or having weed in your system is not a reason why you need to be dead. It's also not a reason for the cops to act as judge, jury, and executioner. It's also important to remember they didn't know that. So how does that become a justification for why they kill him? Whether or not he's acting erratic or he's not complicit is not a reason to kill him.
With all due respect, I strongly disagree. And I do disagree, Brianna, with how you characterize the additional video footage. I don't know if we have it to play it.
You should watch it.
It looks to me like he flees the plea. He is told, this part of the video, he's told to kneel down. He does. But then he later gets back up. He runs off. He's in. Everyone can see him. This police officer who is telling him to do stuff is not aggressive with him. Does not treat him aggressively at all. He's running through traffic. I mean, the danger is that he could get hit by a car. He could put someone. He was just in a car crash.
He's acting
erratically. He did flee the police. They tackle him. I don't disagree with anything the police did at any point of this encounter until I get perhaps. Perhaps they tased him too many times.
Well, that's the bit, Robbie.
Or perhaps when they killed him. That's when you object to when they kill him, but not the actions that lead to them killing him. Robbie, we've had this conversation time and time again, and I don't know how to keep explaining it to you. Fleeing the police is not grounds to be murdered by the police. And I need for you to stop creating this world and this narrative that police are above us. And so if we don't respond to their every command, if we have fear, if we have any different dynamic at play, it justifies the abuse. Whether or not he was in an accident, whether or not he didn't comply, whether or not he was running, you have yet to articulate where he posed the danger to them, where killing him, where tasing him six times is necessary. Everything that you're saying is something that could be discussed. If he were arrested, if he were charged with a crime, if he were alive, they could maybe add resisting arrest or something else or have a reason, but nothing you're saying justifies why he's dead.
I mean, he did resist. Right? He ran from the police.
Wait a minute. No, he didn't. I'm sorry.
Him being dead.
You can say that it's non-compliant to do what he did, which was to get up after being in the seated, kneeling position.
And run away across the street.
No, he announced, I'm going to the street because I want to be more visible. We have it on tape. He announced, I'm going to the street because I want to be seen.
He was perfectly visible where he was in the first place.
You don't know that, first of all. He was up against...
I watched the video. He was in the middle of the...
He was up against...
There were people watching. There are bystanders in that video who say, we can see you, etc.
Like I was saying, he was by a building with his back like come next to a building so you can't get a 360-degree view. Whatever you think of whether he was right or wrong about his visibility, he clearly articulated the reason for why he moved to the street. He did not run into the street. He did not run away. He was clearly not trying to evade arrest. He flagged down the police because he was in a car accident.
Exactly.
Stop trying to project this idea that he's a criminal trying to escape the cops. He's the one that called on the police to be on the scene.
And that's then, very important.
Whatever you think about whether he should have been more or less compliant, he announced his intentions clearly, moved into the street, kneeled, and was on the ground. And at that point, while he was on the ground, we hear him saying, "You're going to George Floyd me. You're going to George Floyd me." The police says, "I'm going to tase you. I'm going to tase you." And then the police, they don't tase him once to subdue him. There are multiple men on the scene, it seems, subduing him. They don't tase him once. They don't tase him twice. They tase him three times in 45 seconds. And the man, a father, a teacher, a 31-year-old, dies. That's the facts. And if you can't imagine, I'm sorry, Robbie, can you not imagine an alternate fact pattern that would have been geared toward preserving that man's life?
Also,
he got up, he ran away from the police. They stopped him multiple times. They said, just sit still.
Robbie,
he did not sit still. They tackled him, then they tased him. It was a long period of noncompliance from him after he just crashed his car on drugs.
Robbie, for the love of God. Okay, first of all, you don't know that none of that. You don't know how his car crashed. You don't know whether drugs had any role in that. People do cocaine and do weed all day, every day, and I'm sure you know it. I know a lot of people that do cocaine, and most of them are prosecutors.
I have no problem with it. I think drugs should be legalized, but you can't drive your car while you're doing it.
Robbie, you're so credulous of the police right now. You're the one who's always talking about not believing what the police say. We don't know anything about the levels of drugs in his blood. You don't know anything.
Robbie always has a I'm anti, recognize the problems with the police narrative until we're discussing somebody that was killed by
Until I saw we the rest of the video footage.
Robbie, we had this conversation. Do you remember when we were having the conversation where the police, where they shot the boy that was eating his sandwich in his car in the parking lot, and we had that whole argument, you talking about, oh, well, he was resisting. We need to keep having a conversation about lawful arrest. You cannot say, if we don't know what the grounds are for the lawful arrest, he approached the police. They weren't arresting him. There was no probable cause or anything like that. He approached them for help. So how is it so that he initiates this interaction with them because he needs help? And then somehow his turning away from that situation when he realizes he's being criminalized, when he realizes he's in danger because he wants to be more visible. Now that's justification. He's resisting the encounter that he initiated. So now that's justification.
What I read is that someone else flagged down the police on his behalf because he crashed his car.
I think we have the video. We have the extended video so people can make up their own mind about what happened here. Let's take a look.
Hey, stop right there.
Yes.
Get up against the wall.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to.
Get up against the wall.
Please, sir, I didn't mean to.
Get up against the wall. Get up against the wall real quick.
Please. Okay, hold on a second.
Please, sir. I didn't mean to, sir. Please.
Hold on. Please. Okay?
I'm sorry.
Against the wall.
Sir.
Have a seat against the wall here.
Everybody got to see me, sir.
Have a seat against
the
wall
over
here.
I want people to see me.
Sure. Okay, you can sit right there then. If you want to be seen,
sit
right there.
No, I don't want to sit right there.
Sit right there if you want to have somebody see you.
Please.
Come here. Come here.
Please.
Come here. Get down over there!
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Turn over on your stomach right now!
Yes.
Turn over on your stomach right now! Turn over!
Yes.
Turn over!
Yes, sir.
Over on your stomach! Get over on your stomach!
Hold on! Okay, please, sir, don't do this, sir! Please! Help me, please!
You know what?
Help me, please! No, please, help me! Help me, please!
Please!
So the question is, Robbie, you know, him seated on the ground in the middle of the street with at least two officers there on the scene, does it feel necessary to you for them to have tased him at that point?
As I said when we started the segment, I don't disagree with anything the police did up until they started tasing him multiple times. I don't know what police procedure is for how many times you're supposed to use a taser. Maybe tasers are too dangerous and shouldn't be used at all. That would be a conversation. I don't know. The decision, maybe tasering him multiple times was not called for. They had him on the ground. He was wrestling and fighting back with them after, like, they gave him many outs. If he had stood still, that police officer did not deploy the taser as its first, you know, line of action against this person who was, as you could see from that video footage, running through the street.
He wasn't running. I'm sorry.
Robbie,
you can say
that
he moved. He wasn't running through the street. There's no need to use hyperbole here. I'm sorry, Ole. Go ahead.
getting into a car accident, whether or not you believe he's the reason for the car accident, people get into car accidents every day that they're at fault for, and that does not arise to a death sentence. That does not justify them being killed. That's one. So whether or not he got into his car accident, whether or not he's to blame, whether or not drugs are in his system, or whether or not he's running or acting erratically, or he's wrestling with them, none of that rose to a threat to those police officers' lives. None of that justifies why he's tased to death. And importantly, we need to stop doing this. You do this thing where it's like, oh, I don't disagree with anything the police did up until they killed him. What we're discussing is them killing him. So either you disagree or you agree with that. But this other discussion of everything before, no, what we're talking about is the fact that they killed this man. He's not alive. And importantly, when you want to discuss a scenario where police they didn't need to use this kind of excessive force. If they had listened to him, if there was compassion for the fact that this man is crying, he's saying, please help me, don't George Floyd me, perhaps they wouldn't tase him 6 times and kill him. But I can only imagine where that lack of compassion comes from when you are watching the video after the fact. They might not even know. Hindsight, they might not have known he would die, but you know he's dead. And you're watching the video still going, oh, well, I don't see any problem with that. And that is a problem because that's how it leads to an environment that fosters why police are able to do this and why we don't actually have the conversations about what shouldn't be allowed, like tasers and this kind of excessive force, because people, unfortunately, Robbie, like you, sit up and justify it.
I saw that from the police, though. I saw that they gave him a lot of leeway for a lot of time. That was not their first action with it. You're acting like they came up to this guy, pulled out their gun, and shot him, which I absolutely would have objected to.
No, Robbie, I'm acting like they killed a man who got into an accident. That is what I'm acting like. I'm acting like they killed someone who didn't need to die, who was not armed, who did not pose a threat to them, who was not dangerous to them, and they have never once, no one here, including any of us, have been able to articulate that at any point in time, this man was a threat to them. So why is killing him necessary?
Yeah, Robbie, it seems to me like you are agreeing that the force that was used that resulted in this man's death was obviously disproportionate, wrong, and likely illegal. We'll see what happens with this lawsuit.
I don't know if it's illegal or not. I don't know what the protocol for using Taser is.
Come on. You don't know whether or not...
I mean, maybe you know, Alimi. Can you tell us?
Yeah, it is excessive force. It's very much so excessive force. So regardless, I just want to point this out. You, when we talk about his death, you don't know whether or not that's illegal. You don't know whether or not the excessive force that we discussed numerous times is legal, but you do seem to know that he is responsible for this car accident, that cocaine and weed caused that. Please stop acting like you have all the facts and you know everything when it comes to vilifying and holding the person that's been killed by the police responsible, but suddenly you need an investigation and you throw your arms up when we're talking about what the police did, which is the subject here, that this man is dead. The police's conduct is who we're discussing, not his.
I'm not vilifying him here.
Robbie,
I don't.
You are, Robbie.
What do you make of that, Robbie? Do you see some inconsistency between your willingness to be credulous about who was at fault or to kind of project an assumption about who's at fault for the accident, whether the substances in his system, no matter what amounts they were in, which we still don't know, were responsible for the accident, and whether, frankly, being, even if it's true, being the cause of a car accident qualifies you to be assassinated on the street. I mean, do you think there's a gap between your credulousness about that stuff but not credulousness about police behavior?
If you had just showed me the first clip that takes place last, the clip of the tasering, if you had just showed me that, I would have been pretty outraged that this seems way disproportionate. Oh, he's even saying you're trying to George Floyd me. But then when you show me all the times before that where they treated with him very reasonably and he didn't respond to that, I understand why they felt they needed to restrain him.
But Robbie,
maybe they still tased him more times than they are supposed to do and that they should be held accountable for that.
Listen to your language. Wait a second. Listen to your language. There's what happened and what didn't happen. He did not respond to the police. We saw him. We all three sat here and saw him kneeling with his hands on his head in front of a building. At some point he said, I want to be more visible, and got up to go to the street. Now, you can think that that was a wrong decision, but you just characterized that as not complying with the police. And I got to say, Robbie, it seems like you keep overcorrecting to exaggerate what this man did. When I can agree that in an ideal world, he might have been alive if he completely lay flat, supine on the ground the second the police arrived after this car accident. Now, I don't drive. I've never been in a car accident. I don't think it's normal behavior, however, to once you flag down the police after a car accident, to lie down face down on the pavement like you're a criminal. However, I can acknowledge that perhaps in that world where he did that, he might be alive. But that's not the question. The question is the obligation of the citizenry to have such a relationship with a hostile, murderous police force that is the way you have to behave to guarantee that you're not going to die in a situation where you were simply in a traffic accident?
I mean, it was his actions that led to that as much as the police actions. If he could have kneeled the first, which he did, and then he ran off again. I mean, it's not, I don't think I don't have any problem. Viewers are going to have to make up their own minds, I guess. Watching how the police handled him up until the point of the tasing, I don't think most people would disagree that they were handling would think they were handling that the wrong way. Maybe people feel differently.
I don't think most people like you would have a problem with Robbie, and I think that's very important. Like, let's make that distinction. Most people like you would never have a problem with that.
Well, I don't know what that means.
What do you mean by that, Ole?
I don't. Because this is the conversation we repeatedly have. It's very clear. Robbie never wants to make this position known in the sand. I've come up to talk to y'all about repeated people that have been killed by the police. And I don't know one time Robbie has had sympathy for the person. In every scenario, we start doing this nimble gymnastics and justifying the murder of this person. It never is a conversation about what the police did wrong or a need to justify. Because at the end of the day, you're saying, oh, I don't have a problem if he hadn't done what beforehand. There is no rule of law. The law is not that if you don't comply with the police, if that you resist the police or that you're afraid of the police or you don't follow their protocol the way that they would have it, or you don't subject to being criminalized the moment they choose to criminalize you. Because again, an important distinction is he flagged down the police for help. He was not a criminal they were seeking out additionally.
I mean, there are many videos where I see police misconduct, and I think it is misconduct because I think they're the things they ask the people to do are unclear. There's so many no-knock raids in the middle of the night where the person is disoriented and confused.
So let me clarify.
A lot of examples of me thinking the police are handling things badly, to be clear.
Robbie. Even if you think that Keenan Anderson did something wrong in his behavior, isn't the evidence of him having been killed with excessive force, it seems 6 tasings in 45 seconds, isn't that evidence that the police also did something wrong? Is that something that you can agree to? That the fact that a man is dead at the end of a traffic incident is not the way the police should be conducting themselves? And there doesn't seem to be a scenario where they should need to use a taser 6 times in 45 seconds on someone who was already on the ground?
Sure, I think I said that.
So that's something I think that's worth acknowledging and emphasizing that.
I would also like to know what the training is with the taser, and maybe what they're recommended to do with the taser is inappropriate if it can result or frequently result, or I don't know what the statistics would be, is likely to cause some kind of grave harm. There should be some policy that you tase someone once, you don't tase them repeatedly. I don't know what they're instructed to do. That would be part of the blameworthiness, it's worth asking that question,
and perhaps, Olayemi, you can come back and talk to us a little bit more about what the status of that conversation is. I do know that there has been a debate about the use of tasers for exactly this reason. We appreciate you, as always, joining us to discuss today.
Thank you. Thank you so much, y'all. Bye.
All right. And we'll have more Rising for you right after this.
Disgraced socialite Ghislaine Maxwell has given her first televised interview from federal prison in Florida. Speaking to the British outlet Talk TV, Maxwell stopped short of an apology when asked if she had anything to say to her victims.
What do you say to the many women who feel betrayed by you and want you to stay in jail?
I say that Epstein died and they should take their disappointment and upset out on the authorities that allowed that to happen.
Then later, when asked about her relationship with Bill Clinton, she bizarrely lavished praise on the former U.S. president.
Well, he's one of the most interesting people I've ever met. He was extremely sharp and interesting, and has a broad range of
However, the interview's biggest bombshell came when Maxwell was asked whether she believes her former associate, Jeffrey Epstein, really committed suicide.
I believe that he was murdered. Well, I was shocked. And I wondered how it had happened. Because as far as I was concerned, I was sure he was going to appeal. And I was sure that he was covered under the non-prosecution agreement. But I wasn't in the indictment.
She thought he was going to appeal. It seems like she, on some level, thought that he could still avoid jail time or get out of jail.
Well, he did the first time. That's not a crazy belief to have at all.
That is certainly true. And one might even connect the weirdly laudatory description of Bill Clinton to, you know, if she seems like a kind of person who has this weird respect for authority or power or kind of investment in power. And maybe she just genuinely believe that, you know, bad things happen to other people, jail time happens to other people, that for folks like them, they're kind of above it all. And it has been, to your point, the case certainly in the past. I mean, look, this is in the context we reported on this, of her doing this kind of, having taken this feminism turn where she was teaching women's classes in jail, yoga.
Well, I mean, she's got to find a way to pass the time. I mean,
yes, well, teaching a yoga class is, I think, a little bit different from teaching, you know, modeling behavior in an etiquette class. I think the irony of someone who is in jail for her role in sex trafficking of young girls probably shouldn't be teaching other people how to behave in social situations or how to be polite, upstanding young women in society. I mean, I think the hypocrisy of that would probably preclude me from attending her class, if not my disgust with what she has
been
accused
and
convicted of.
This is like a mob enforcer teaching accounting or something.
Exactly. Although they might know what's coming.
They might have some good tips for you.
They might have a few good tips. I don't know. What do you make of it? Are you especially surprised by her saying she thinks that Epstein
killed himself? No. It doesn't really matter. She doesn't have more information about the circumstances of his demise than anyone else. I thought, actually, Ryan and I would argue about this because he was more in the vein of thinking that he might have actually been killed. I tend to think that, you know, people kill themselves in prison all the time. It's a neglectful environment. It's not actually surprising to me that the cameras weren't working or that the security guards weren't really paying attention because it's a depressing, horrible environment. There's not a lot of care in the system toward incarcerated people staying alive, frankly. So it is not. It doesn't surprise me. It doesn't.
It could happen.
It does happen. It happens all the time.
Right.
So that was kind of my standpoint.
Most of the time, the people who are committing suicide in jail are not as high priority prisoners who have as many eyes on them, about whom there's all of this fear that they're going to do it and, you know, anticipated danger and risk assessment, right? Like, there were people who immediately started anticipating that because of all that Epstein knew and all of the powerful people that he could potentially bring down, that he was a target. And that's partly why there was supposed to be heightened scrutiny of him and more protections on him. So that happening in that context did seem to be more anomalous to some folks, at least.
Yeah. No, it's definitely true, and it's... I understand why people think that. I don't think it's crazy to think maybe it was something like that at all. But she doesn't really know either. It's interesting to hear, you know, her perspective, I guess.
She knows something about, let's say, I mean,
I guess she knows about his mindset,
state, yeah,
maybe.
And whether he's ever maybe had suicidal ideation before. Look, again, that doesn't mean everything.
But somebody could,
a new situation.
Could be very unlikely or very not inclined towards suicide, be in the circumstance he was in and see that as the most rational way out.
I mean, look, the other aspect of this that's kind of interesting is, I mean, she has in the course of her trial made certain appeals to sexism and femininity to insulate herself against, of course, the charges, and then also to kind of gain some public sympathy. You know, she made this argument in the course of her trial that it was unfair that she was being targeted with this stuff. As the woman in the situation, Epstein was already dead. You know, it was this odd take. And I recently heard someone interviewing her in a documentary about the case, saying that there was this gap between how she talked about people in her kind of class milieu and the girls that were trafficked and set up. And exploited, and how she referred to them as kind of like nothing. Like, oh, they don't really matter. They're just... And so, again, I think that's part of what is sitting uneasy with me, the idea that she's doing this, like, wellness guru turn and kind of leaning into this yes, queen version of a sex trafficker, when it seems like in her real life, I mean, obviously, given the nature of the crime, she behaves with such indifference to the lives and suffering of the girls that were exploited. And I don't know, I find it to be very off-putting. The public has an understandable interest in her. We don't often see women prisoners of this high profile who used to have a glamorous life that were this close to famous people who attended, you know, the former president's wedding. I mean, there's obviously a reason.
I guess I don't really care how she spends her time. If she's in prison, she deserves to be there. She's going to be there for a long time. Beyond that, I think maybe I'm the softy. I get to be the criminal justice softy for once.
Robin,
I don't. Prisoners
it's not about
can,
how she spends her time.
I don't
it's
care.
Whether or not
they,
she's trying to curry favor with the public or the criminal justice system by painting herself as a victim. This is the thing that we talk about with weaponized identity politics all the time, that while marginalized identities certainly have grievances and have been historically persecuted and disadvantaged legally by our justice system. Women not being able to take out credit cards on their own until the late 70s, early 80s, and on down the line. People who use a kind of girl boss feminism to avoid the consequences of their actual legitimately terrible behaviors poisons the concept of what it means to advocate on the basis of your marginalized group in the first instance. I'm someone who's been very critical of weaponized identity politics, but the identity isn't the problem. It's people like her who cynically use it to get off on things that she 100% is culpable for.
Well, she's not getting off. She's in prison.
Right, but she's tried. She's tried, but she seems to be continuing to try to curry that kind of favor. You know, we all understand this idea of like, oh, bombs, they're dropping bombs on countries that, you know, America shouldn't be bombing, but the plane is painted pink and has like a breast cancer flag on the back, so we're supposed to think it's good. You know, we have what was it, the woke FBI, the diversity commercial for the deep state that had like, I have, you know, ADHD and I have anxiety and I work for the FBI too, or I work for the CIA too, whatever it was. I mean, that we see that kind of thing all over the place, and I can't help but see it happening here and point it out as pernicious.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. It is funny. It's something we mock, I think, for good reason all the time. The whole, yay, progressive, yay.
Yeah.
Stick a rainbow flag on that bomb we're about to, to drop in.
And there's nothing wrong with the rainbow flag. It's Raytheon's use of the rainbow flag. That's
it's the bomb we don't like.
It's the bomb we don't like. Yeah.
All right. We'll have more Rising right after this. Stay with us.
Release some greenhouse gases. I'm obviously a stranger to online controversy. It's not something I often do. But now, the mainstream press is commenting on the fact that I was informing Greta that my very extensive car collection with internal combustion engines, which run on dead dinosaurs, have an enormous emission profile. And she replied by telling me her own email address. Greta's email address is, I have small energy. Why would that be your own email address, Greta? Strange. I mean, also, I don't want to assume her gender. It's 50-50, but it is what it is. I'm not actually mad at Greta. Please bring me pizza and make sure that these boxes are not recycled. Thank you. So I'm not actually mad at Greta, right? Because she doesn't realize she's been programmed. She doesn't realize she's a slave of the Matrix. She thinks she's doing good.
That was, of course, the infamous video of Andrew Tate responding to Greta Thunberg. Shortly thereafter, he was arrested in Romania, and then there was the rumor that it was because of the video, although we later learned that was not actually true. He now says he is facing inhumane conditions while being held pretrial in Romanian jail. According to the New York Post, fans recently received an email message from the self-described toxic masculinity king. Tate writes, quote, "They are trying to break me, thrown inside a cell without light. Cockroaches, lice, and bedbugs are my only friends at night. When the guards bring me to and from the courtroom, I stay absolutely respectful. They try to pour hatred into my heart." Although he does also acquit the guards. I pulled up this this message he wrote where he says that the guards, they agree with him. They think they've told him they know he's innocent.
Mm-hmm.
They know it's unjust, and they see I will never break, and they respect my resolve. Such is the way of Wudan.
Fascinating. Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff there.
So he was supposed to be, his time in jail was extended another 30 days. He was not given bail. I would gather that they thought he was a significant flight risk.
Yeah, I mean, look, he says he moved to Romania
to avoid charges.
Because the rape charges rape, you know, it was easier to avoid rape charges there. There was a video, we played it last week on the show, of him talking about his behavior toward women, which some people felt like were grounds for an earlier arrest, but the authorities at that point said it wasn't enough. I think those were British authorities at that point who said it wasn't enough.
I saw a lot of scrutiny about whether that was actually him on that call.
Yeah.
Do we know that for certain? I don't know.
I mean, the courts will say. I think that part of the issue is that his fan base is extremely loyal, and they haven't necessarily been engaging, I think, with the facts and substance of the allegations as they've come out in a way that makes them especially credible. Of course, who knows anything, but I wouldn't necessarily take the arguments being made by a lot of his fans at face value. It's worth remembering that so much of what we know about him is through his own disclosures. This is from a recent NBC report, which says, in podcast appearances, news interviews, and social media posts since 2021, Tate said that he employed women to make money for him by performing in webcam pornography, controlled their behavior, and evaded law enforcement. He also advertised content sold to teach people about how they can replicate his business model. Tate and his brother told The Mirror in a June 2022 interview that they ran a, quote, total scam business in Romania that used cam models to lure men into sending them money. Additionally, he once... in addition to the scam stuff, he once boasted on his website that he lured women in by getting them to fall in love with him, and that he once broke a woman's jaw in a bar fight and, quote, got away with it.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, and what you're describing, we've gotten into this several times when we discuss this, you're describing some really bad things, some potentially criminal things for sure, if they're proven. It could, you know, it is disgusting to boast about having hit a woman, but maybe that's his persona and he's just saying that he did that. If he actually did it, that would be a crime. That would be assault. But nothing that you described actually sounds like sex trafficking to me. It sounds like it could be illegal, especially the con with the business, taking people's money for false purposes, manipulating women, being very creepy, assault, maybe sexual assault. It doesn't sound to me like he necessarily forced people to engage. But maybe he did. Maybe they have evidence that he did. But
I mean, I think the issue is whether or not it's sex trafficking. The issue is whether he fraudulently induced these women to create explicit content for him that he profited from, because he misled them into believing that they were in a relationship, and then also lured them away from their homes, made them financially dependent on him, perhaps also abused them, and as a consequence, was able to exploit them for profit.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's sex trafficking or not. I'm not a criminal prosecutor.
I mean, it sounds like a cult. Why I interrupted you, I'm sorry.
No, just I'm not a criminal prosecutor, but it seems to me that there is a lot in there that could be considered to be illegal.
Well, it sounds to me a lot like cult sort of behavior. You know, people fall under the sway of a charismatic, the cult figure, and you think, how could people fall? How can we get them out? But what they're doing is not...
Well, the cult leaders go to jail all the time. I don't know if you follow the whole NXIVM scandal, but people involved went to jail, because it's not just I'm standing there being charismatic and people want to pay me money to hear me talk. You know, Tim Robbins isn't in jail. The issue is that these people, they extract money for promised goods that are not delivered. Mm-hmm. They take over people's bank accounts. They commit all kinds of actual fraud.
Yeah.
And that's what they end up going down over. So we'll see this. It seems, by his own admission, that his business model is to fraudulently induce women to create free pornographic content for him that he profits from by pretending that he is in a relationship with them. And we'll see if anything happens, if there are any consequences for that kind of behavior. I mean, it does seem like that this stuff is just the tip of the iceberg. He's made a lot of money. To his point, he has many, many cars with many gaseous emissions. That have now been confiscated, and he paid for that with money from this enterprise. So there's a lot.
His views got he gets massive views on social media. Easy to imagine him monetizing that very successfully. He's a celeb reality TV star type person, and then you could see how what he was doing would be lucrative and again potentially illegal, certainly scammy. I think he's a con artist regardless. But I don't know. I wonder if they're going to have a harder time pinning something on him than we're all being led to believe. I really do.
Yeah, look, like I said, there was apparently an argument that the police should have moved in earlier when that tape first surfaced, and the decision was made at that point to hold off because there wasn't enough. So I would presume that the fact that they moved in now is because they have more. Like, I don't think that this doesn't seem like this was an impulsive decision. And to your point, it wasn't because of Greta Thunberg either. That just happens to have been a coincidence that happened at the same time. So, look, again, I don't know. Nobody knows. But what we do know is that this is someone who has bragged about his own bad behavior. Again, yeah, I hear your point. It could just all be performative. But even the choice to performatively brag about this kind of behavior is not something that a lot of people support. And there's been an interesting conversation that's emerged around this about why it is that this particular kind of persona is so attractive to young men right now.
Right, we've been trying to understand that. Well, the discussion of his jail conditions is interesting. I mean, being in prison is terrible. It's awful. It's I found this interesting when the January 6th people who went into the Capitol, you know, they got put in prison, and they're describing these horrible conditions. And it is horrible. It's horrible to be held in solitary confinement as they wait trial for months and months and months, you know, even if indeed they're guilty of trespassing or of something worse. You know, it's no matter what you are, it's you deserve a speedy trial, and then if you're found guilty, you have to go to prison, and you shouldn't languish in unbearable conditions while you're awaiting that. And I think the mainstream press kind of had a, well, these bad guys, these Trump guys, they're getting what they deserve. And, like, look, they, like anyone else, like Andrew Tate, like, deserve your day in court. And then if you're guilty, you're guilty.
Yeah, these conditions are horrible. The consequence of committing a crime is to be restrained, not to be tortured, not to be raped. So, I certainly don't think that anybody should have expressed glee at especially difficult conditions. However, there is, I think it is worthwhile to note the hypocrisy of folks who don't care about bail reform, who don't care about the condition of prisoners because they think it's for other people, a class of people that they don't see themselves as a part of, suddenly being in the prison system and suddenly having concerns about it. I do think it's worth pointing out.
Yeah, I think that's
you're right, but you're also a big hypocrite.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
Well, tomorrow on Rising, Marianne Williamson will join us, and we're going to ask her about the exploratory committee she's convened to look at a potential 2024 run for president.
Be sure to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss any content. And for those of you who like to listen while on the go, we are now available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
See you tomorrow. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.